Hey, man. Welcome to our Morningstar Men's Ministry podcast for the 14th of May. We're continuing, actually wrapping up our series, What to Do When You Don't Know What to Do. And this week, we're looking at a couple of key features of making decisions and then managing those decisions. The first is when it's possible to make decisions progressively. That is to commit incrementally, putting, so to speak, one toe in the water and testing the decision and then gradually moving into the decision more deeply until you reach what we might want to call a point of no return. The other thing that we're going to look at is the value of leadership when it comes to making decisions. Who are the people who help you to make good decisions? Some of them you know and you meet, you encounter face to face. But I'll bet if you look back across your life and some of the critical decisions you made, that there are people whom you have never met face to face who have had a significant impact on making some of those decisions. Perhaps it's authors who've crafted books, and the ideas that you read in those books have made a difference in your life. Perhaps it's people you've listened to, either television or radio or perhaps just podcasts. Maybe it's a great TED Talk that you've heard, and in one way or another that inspired you to move out, to step out into a decision that you otherwise might not have. We all need great leaders. That's somewhat obvious. But the less obvious part of this that we're going to consider today is that each of us in God's kingdom has a leadership role and a leadership responsibility. That it's not equally divided, so to speak, where there's some leaders and some followers. But in fact, in the kingdom of God, in various aspects, we are all leaders and we are all followers. And in one way or another, we need each other. At times, we are the leader and others are following in along with us. And at times, we're a follower. So we'll look at some of the challenges of being both a leader and a follower and what that has to do with making and managing decisions. Okay, guys, hope you're blessed by this podcast, and we'll see you again next week. The handouts are going to be a little confusing today. It's okay, we'll just call them my notes to myself, which you get the privilege of following along with. All right. We are wrapping up this week the What to Do When You Don't Know What to Do. We're going to look at a few different ideas, and then at the end, if there's any questions, any interaction that anybody has, then we'll deal with that then. After this week, I don't know. How's that? I'm thinking I might not do a review of this. Normally, when we have a multi-part series, I'll do a final wrap-up week, but I might surprise you with something entirely different, new by next week. We'll see. Okay. Two verses that I think capture this ambiguity that we live with. The first one from Solomon, it's the glory of God to conceal a matter. To search out a matter is the glory of kings. Okay, so remember the Proverbs are based on past experience. And so whether Solomon himself created this simple way of remembering and thinking about a dilemma in life that he faced, or whether it's something that he noticed from someone else, or heard from someone else, he apparently thought it was worthy of capturing. Again, it is the glory of God to conceal a matter. To search out a matter is the glory of kings. So, a while back, you might remember that we introduced the idea that the scriptures call us or refer to us as lowercase g gods. In other words, we are people who have a domain, a territory that it is our responsibility to rule and govern on behalf of God. So each of us has a terrain or a domain that it is our responsibility to govern. Do you see yours this morning? You know what it is. You know the things over which you have influence, the things that you're responsible for, the things that you could have influence over if you chose to. That's your domain. And so now, because we've set that as the foundation, to search out a matter is the glory of kings. Therefore, what's it our job to do? Well, let's look at the second verse here that I thought was good for juxtaposition. He said, "For we are God's workmanship, created in Christ Jesus to do good works, which God has prepared in advance for us to do." Now notice that, which God has prepared in advance for us to do, and yet Solomon's experience, and it's probably the experience of each of us at times, is it's the glory of God to conceal a matter. When I was younger in the parenting kids at home phase of my life, there was something that I would do, and I've shared this with some of you already. There's a way that I would test how serious one of my kids was about whether they really wanted to do something. So if my kids came to me, and those of you who have kids at home, you already understand what I'm about to say next, they'd come to you almost every new day with something that they wanted to do, right? It was as predictable as the sun coming up in the morning, your kids would want to do something. And so I'd just remember, to the best of my ability, I'd remember all these things. And if a recurring theme arose month after month after month, I'd start to notice a pattern and think they were serious. In other words, if every new day they woke up and it was just a new, never-ending shopping list, laundry list of things that they wanted, I really wouldn't take it too seriously. But if over a year's time, they kept expressing the same idea, then I'd think, okay, this is something that their hearts are really set on, and perhaps it's worth looking at. Food wasn't one of those things. I didn't test them for a year to see. They didn't come to me every day and say, I'm hungry. And I said, well, let's see if you're still hungry tomorrow. Well, I think it's that way with us and God a lot of times. We're looking for just, God's here, just do this. Instead, God is actually saying to us, what do you notice? What do you see? What do you want to pursue? What do you find dissatisfactory in your life? So how many of, and I don't just mean your life, but your domain, remember? We're kings. And in that series, we said that the role of a king is to act on behalf of his subjects, to act on behalf of those in his area of influence. And so that's our role. What are the deficiencies that you notice in your world? Let's take a look at this or read this next piece together. Many of us have been schooled in a gospel in which there is one set and pat answer to things. We are thus uncomfortable with ambiguity, with making choices in the absence of clear guidance and without guaranteed outcomes. What do we call making choices without the guarantee of success? Yes, we do. In a nutshell, the word I was looking for, risk. How many of us like risk? Some do, some don't. Be honest with yourself. What is your comfort level with risk? Some people run toward it. Some people will do almost anything to avoid it. You may need to act in humble confidence while using what you already know and believe so as to govern your movement. And move ahead with an act of faith, believing that you have seen a thing which should be done. And this next part is important. And have an authority to act. And so now face into it and do it. Do you believe that you have authority to act in your area of influence? This is a really tough thing for some believers to confront. That you and I have actually been given authority to do certain things within our domain. And it's simply our responsibility. We don't need to ask God's permission. We don't need to get His go-ahead to do something that needs to be done within our domain. We need to spend more time asking the question, how can I best do this in a way that passes through those other filters that we've already talked about? How can I do this in a way that remains consistent with God's law of love? How can I do this in a way that has the potential to bring some honor to God? Now, what if I waste all that time asking God if it's His will to do that? So it refocuses my attention on, do I have permission, when God has already said, in a lot of cases, you've already got my permission, just go and do it. This is the next thing that we're uncomfortable with. Your manner of execution might be noticeably different from that of your neighbor. One of the things that school kids do is they look to take their cues from the kid next to them. If somebody else near them is doing it, then they think it's okay for them to do. There's a well-known motivational speaker of several generations ago, and he said that the problem isn't that we have the game that kids play, which is called Follow the Leader. The problem that we have in both child life and adult life is that we have this other game, and it's Follow the Follower. And in Follow the Follower, nobody is actually in charge or actually is comfortable knowing what they're doing, so we all just follow each other, and everybody thinks that the person in front of them is actually kind of like in control and knows what they're doing. But if you could actually get to the front of the line, there is no front of the line, because at the front of the line, there's somebody else who's following somebody else that's at the back of the line, and you're just going in a massive circle. Do you believe that God has given you not only a realm of influence and an authority to act, but that you have the capability to act on his behalf and act wisely. And that's why we say your manner of execution might be noticeably different from that of your neighbor. Are you trying to do your family the way the family next door is doing it because you're not sure that you have the comfort level to stand alone? Are you trying to run your business, do your this, do that, according to the way that you see everybody else doing it? And it doesn't mean that we don't borrow great ideas from other people. But you and I have to, as regents, as lowercase g gods, be able to make decisions and then live with those decisions. Good leaders attempt to unite people in outcomes and inspire them toward personal actions. We need, now this is each of us, a group of people who we're actually partnering with, and there's supposed to be an us there, so that good works, which both they and we are attempting to do, are not thwarted by the absence of one or more good things which another can bring to our endeavor. All right. So our overarching theme for this morning is we all need leaders and we all are leaders. That means in one or another area of life, each of us needs leadership. The proof of this is, and we won't go around the room, don't worry, we're not going to put this to the test, but I will guarantee you that if we were to put this to the test, you are stuck in one area of your life. There is some area of stuckness. And there might be 20 areas, it's a word. There might be one or more areas in life where you excel. And you should be the leader. But there's one or more areas in life where you're stuck. And the difference between your remaining stuck or ever getting out of the stuckness is you're going to need to have some consultation with somebody else.
What if you see too much stuff?
Instead of what?
Stuff.
Because struggle... Now, this might be different for each of us, okay? Struggle implies I could yet figure this out by myself. Stuckness involves I'm where I am and I'm probably not getting out of this without somebody else's help or intervention. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing, but what it forces me to do is, and we'll get into this, by the time you've left, well, no, it's probably sometime after you've left, we'll actually get into the part where I'll back this up, but... Struggle does imply... How many of you have struggled silently through something, figuring, if I just have one more a day, surely I can figure this out? How many of you have spent a month there? A year there?
Years. Yeah.
That's a long day.
Can we all agree that there's a point where we move from struggle, which is a battle which we think we have some optimistic hope of winning, to stuck, where there, it seems that we have no hope of getting beyond this. So we need each other, but we're going to get into this because I know when we say use the phrase, we need each other, it sounds so warm and fuzzy and cliche and something like we should say in church, but we still don't live like that. All right. And that's part of the discovery process that we have to discover in ourselves. Remember? It's the delight of God to conceal things. It's the glory or the delight of the King to discover them. What is it that's inside of each of us that we personally need to discover? What is the area where you can lead? And we'll get into some specific types of leadership in a minute. One of the things that Jim just did that I want you to latch on to, And he didn't know that he did it. But he framed up a problem that each of us experiences, and he placed it in a different context that felt safe to look at it. So one of the things that we didn't talk about last week was the value of great metaphors to help us unlock the areas where we're stuck. And some people are really gifted at being able to communicate things in a way that makes us look at our lives in a different way. So for instance, have you ever had a friend that was stuck? And the friend came to you, and they weren't really looking for an answer. They were just looking for a place to complain. You know what I mean? They really didn't want you to give them guidance. They just wanted somebody to listen to the fact that they were the most unlucky person in the world. Right? We've all experienced that. And what happens after 5 minutes you listen to the guy's tale of woe? It may not even be the first time you've heard the tale of woe. And then you say, well, that seems so obvious. If you just do this, this, and then this, you'll be out of this mess and you can move on with your life. And truthfully, that's it. If he would just do this, this, and this, he'd probably be out of the mess in his life. Why is it that somebody from outside can notice something and call to our attention and give us a call to action that we seem incapable of doing? Is it that we're stupid?
No. It goes back to your original thing, the gift things and the understanding and how things work and how you grew up and what's been placed into you as to whether or not you believe
And that is the beauty of a story. Because a story disarms you from your own preoccupation with being stuck. Right? What don't we all like to fix somebody else's problems? Why is that so easy? But a metaphor that someone else, like Jim just gave us, with the idea of comparing our stuckness in life to a work situation where he said we all need other people and we don't find it unusual to depend on other people at work. Why is it that we find it so unusual or rare to depend on people in our personal lives or in other areas of life? And he just posed that as a simple question. But it's a useful tool. A good story helps us to look at our own problem as if we were an outsider to the problem. Remember Nathan the prophet and David? And Nathan confronts David over the adultery? And why does David fall so hook, line, and sinker for that? Because he thinks it's somebody else's problem. He thinks it's something that he has been called on to fix, and he's going to step into the gap and fix it. And he doesn't realize what he's just prescribed is to fix himself in not a very pleasant way. So one of the things that is a tremendous gift to you and I is if we're either able to tell ourselves stories about our own life that help us to look at it in a different way, or if we're able to speak into each other's lives in story form so that we can take our situation and look at it without the emotion that's attached to it. There's a second reason why it's easier for us to diagnose somebody else's problem. When it's somebody else's problem, we don't feel the emotional pain that goes with having to make the change. You see, when I look at you and I say, well, it's easy, just do this, this, and this, what's running through your mind? Yeah, well, you don't understand how hard it is to do this, this, and this. I've tried this for the last 10 years, and it doesn't work. So you don't want to hear my three steps to an easy life. Right? You want to be stuck.
Well, what that guy doesn't realize is that he's never tried it either. He's just giving you the simple. He's just throwing something at you.
Well, not always.
Really, he's just throwing something at you to try to prove how right he is, how smart he is, and to shut you up. Because you've been yammering on about this for 10 years now. He's never really tried it either. Otherwise, he'd take you through it himself.
He would take you through it himself. We're going to get to that in a minute. Do you always feel inclined to rush on ahead? Always.
Sure. Always.
Okay. So, two different situations that'll help us with making decisions. Do you always need to decide something in the moment?
Yeah.
All or nothing, yes or no? No, we don't. And so there's two different stories that I'm going to tell you in the moment in a moment that are going to kind of illustrate that. But let's look at the role that experience plays in making decisions. So I have these two phrases down, and they really sum up something. And I wrote the first phrase down, and then later on I started to think about the second phrase. And I realized that we have these expressions built into our everyday language. There's a phrase which is so common among entrepreneurs that it's almost a cliche. It took longer than I expected and cost more than I projected. Okay, now let's look at the second one. There's an ironic paradox to this. The phrase which large contractors in almost any industry pride themselves on is to describe themselves as on time and under budget. Do you realize when you look at them, if we whiteboarded both of them, they're the exact opposite of each other. The entrepreneur says it took longer and cost more. The experienced contractor says we did it on time and it cost no more than or even less than. What's the difference between the two? Well, the contractor's selling you on it, but here's the thing. What's the difference between an entrepreneur and an experienced contractor? The entrepreneur is always trying something that's never been done before or trying to do something in a different way, and therefore he has no frame of reference for what it really should cost. It's all guesswork.
Even a contractor can go, oh, you know what, I missed it. That's going to cost us more than I expected. I never saw that. I didn't see that coming.
But he also has things that experience has taught him, or has taught them, I should say.
Put it in the contract.
And there's safeguards. Okay, well, if this goes bad, we'll make it up on this part of the project. Right? Only in government defense contracting can you get away with never being on time and under budget.
What is the difference between sales and that? You know what I mean? The sales guy is oftentimes trying to get a sold, so he's going to tell you this, and then it does this, but the guy doing the work goes, wait a minute, you forgot a whole bunch of stuff.
Okay, so let's keep focused on the two classifications of people.
The contractor has a lock clause because he doesn't know he's going to hit it.
And he experienced it before. How many of us lack experience at something we're trying to decide on right now? That's a personal question. Are you trying to make a decision right now? Or are you trying to manage a decision that you've made in the past and you lacked some key piece of experience? The difference between the entrepreneur and the contractor in this case is that the contractor is bidding on his next job based on years of experience. I've shared this with you before. I'll do it very quickly now just to illustrate this. When I first started out doing things, I had no experience. And so I'd go in and I'd bid on a job, and yeah, we can do that. My contracts were the one-page variety that you go to the business supply store and get. And you jot a few notes down about what you intend to do, or you type them out and you mail them in and they mail them back, and it's like all good, and it looks sort of like an official piece of paper. It took me a year before I threw away the packaged contractor forms and never used them again. Because by the end of a year, hanging on to what little of my business life was left, I realized that I had to put a few rock clauses in, right? And so over a period of time, I got a reputation for being able to write a great and clear contract. Why? People would ask me that. Why are your contracts so great? Well, you don't want to know. Every clause in that contract is there because I learned not the easy way, but the hard way that it belongs there. Yes?
I have to say something. What you're saying is what every contractor would eventually like to have to get the job. But the entrepreneur and the contractor, the ones that knows what they're doing, and the entrepreneur that thinks they know what they're doing, won't look at you or me right in the rock clause. They're like, I kind of like this one because it's 50% cheaper, and I'm just going to go with that guy. So, you know, I'm dying to know how this all fits together.
Somewhere in your life, And what we're going to look at in a minute, just for the benefit of Jim, who's not going to be here when we actually get to look at it, is Paul suggests that there's a way that community can work together so that we can actually inform each other. And this is why I said, in one way or another, every one of us needs leaders, but each of us is a leader. There's just so much junk standing in the way, either of you believing that you can lead in some area or feeling comfortable being led. And that's the truth of the matter. This is the personal internal struggle. The solutions to a lot of your problems already exist. Somebody knows the solution to your problem. It's just in one way or another, there's things standing between a community of people coming together and helping each other to solve each of our problems and work together for, actually, for the glory of God.
Well, and the easiest way that I know of to put that on sort of a flat track, look at how this works out in the world, and look at the military. Have the guy who just come in, went behind the ears, doesn't know anything, he's scared to death, and you have that guy that charges right in there because he's been there before. He already knows what's going on. Battlefield, he goes, they're not there, they're right there. He sees the flash, he hears the sound, he looks at the land, the lay of the land, he already knows. That's what kind of hears. All he hears is gunfire. And then, you know what I mean? The other guy's a seasoned veteran who's been through this before. He sees artillery coming in, and he already knows. And he says, I'll get you through this if you do what I tell you to do.
But there's something else that's going on there at the same time. So I'm going to take and I'm going to insert this into a movie context. One of the things that keeps tension in a great movie, where there is somebody like that, right? There is the grizzled, experienced veteran who's fought many a battle, done many a thing, and he actually can save the day. But have you ever noticed that in a great movie, to build tension, there's always one piece that the old, experienced warrior doesn't have? And a lot of times that one single piece is in the hands of the rookie. It's the piece of information or understanding that the rookie has that nobody else has. Have you ever been the seasoned veteran but you didn't want to take any advice from the rookie, and there was that one time when the rookie actually knew what he was talking about and it would make the difference between saving the day or not? And I know that's movie terminology, but... As which?
Old guy working on something, stuck it for a day and a half. Young guy just got out of school. He was just trained in the latest, greatest, cool new stuff. And I'm like, that's it. I'm done. I give up. I'm not working on a piece of garbage anymore. Blah, 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 blah. Young buck, who I disregarded completely because he's brand new, doesn't know anything yet, walks over and goes, oh, yeah, you know what? You have to do this, this, and this, and then that'll. Shut up.
Okay, now there's a real life experience.
But because I dismissed him as, you don't know what you're talking about. You're too young, you don't have anything to offer. When you do that, you really make yourself unteachable. No good.
Okay, so two stories. The first, and I don't know if any of you have ever heard of these companies, but we'll deal with them pretty quickly. So the guy's name is Adam Grant, wrote a book called The Originals, and in it he describes an investment opportunity that he had. He teaches college courses in business and entrepreneurship, and he said it was in their senior year that a group of college kids came to him, three of them precisely, and they said, would you be willing to invest in our new endeavor? And they knew, he said, that from time to time I'll take some of my money and make small investments or sometimes large investments. And he says, I've done pretty well at actually investing in small businesses that some of my students have started. Well, these three kids came to me. He said, we have an idea for selling glasses online. All right, well, my interest level, he said, dropped a little bit as soon as they described that, because immediately I saw all the problems with trying to sell glasses online. It just didn't seem like it could be done. But then I asked him a little bit more. He said, I've learned over the years that I shouldn't prematurely judge something. So I asked him a few more questions. And the first question I asked was, well, I guess if you're starting this business as soon as you get out of school, that you probably... You've thrown all your eggs into this basket, so I guess you're not going to have any income. And they said, oh no, I've hired on with a firm already, and I've taken this consultation job, and I've done this. So the next thing he thinks to himself is, okay, so they're in a business that I don't think is a good, viable business. Not only that, But they've all hedged their bets by getting other day jobs so that they're not even going to be fully invested in this business. So they have no chance. They'll bail. And they won't be bailing with their money. They'll be bailing with my money. But then it went on. He said to them, let me think about it. And it got a little closer and they approached him again. Now remember, it was going to be a business selling glasses online. Well, the critical component of selling glasses online is a really viable, functional, working website, right? Because that, by definition, is your store. So I posed this question to them, he says. How far along are you on your website? Oh, well, we haven't done much work on that yet. And that day, he said, I made the decision that I was not going to invest in them. And I told them that. And he jokingly then later says, since that time, I've allowed my wife to have more influence over the things that we invest in. Because the name of the firm, which I had never heard of up until then, but apparently has a good name in this industry, is Warby Parker. I don't know if anybody's ever heard of it, but apparently they do a really serious multi-billion dollar business in eyeglassware online. So I guess if you need glasses today, now would be a good time to go check that out. I don't know. But their whole concept is they will mail you multiple frames to see if something fits, if you like it, if you look at yourself in the bathroom mirror and it looks marvelous, and they somehow...
Oh. You can send it back. I used that.
Oh, who would have guessed, right? There's Mr. Jim, the grizzled warrior in the back, and he's in touch with cutting edge. How about that? So anyway...
And the website works great.
It does. Okay. So here's the thing. Do you have a way to delay and incrementally inch into this decision? When is that appropriate and when isn't it? And this is where I want to pull all this together. Remember, one of the filters that we said we pass things through is, does it pass God's law of love? And we emphasized it that way. Do you remember why we said, does it filter through God's law of love? Do you remember why we called it that? Because it's not God's arbitrary list of things that we should and shouldn't do. It's God's commitment to us saying, if you will live in this way, it will go well for you. So when we pass something through the filter, does it pass God's law of love? We're not doing it to make God happy. We're actually doing it simply because it honors God, and ultimately it goes better for us. All right, so there's some decisions we can't incrementally beyond a certain point, right? But we see it in society, right? What does the couple do that has been engaged for a while, or they're thinking about being a couple? What does that couple do if they say, well, we'll just incrementally try this out? Well, they say, well, let's move in with each other, right? We don't know yet, so we'll try it out. There does come a point when I have to make a commitment. And that's why we say you can't just indiscriminately make these choices. Pass them through the filters that we've talked about. So as soon as I pass that through the filter, should we move in together? Should we try this out? Does it meet with God's law of love? No. Okay, well then I need to look for another option. There is a point where you do need to commit.
Well, I think that there are problems with the decision-making process is the commitment that people make. People just don't commit. The only thing I can think of is when I forget what the army was. They came across the sea, and he said, burn the boats. Why? Because if you don't, they're going to want to go home.
Mm-hmm.
And they will not face this direction. They'll constantly look that direction. You know what I mean? Marriage is burning the boats. That's it. You're in here. You're in here. That's it. If you want to get out, you've got a whole bunch of trouble. So just it's easier just to stick it out. Do what you need to do. Try your best, not half-heartedly. Try your best because the option sucks, you know. And just, I think that word commitment to something that is good, commitment to a greater purpose, commitment to the betterment of the community, that's lacking. For the most part, commitment for us.
I want to come back to the second story in a couple minutes, but before that, what I'd like to do is have us turn over to Colossians. And while you go there, I want to describe for us these two different types of leadership. So the first type of leadership that we all need is some sort of visionary leadership that paints for us a picture of something that we could do. So think to yourself, have you ever listened to someone read a book and been inspired to do something? Has someone's presentation to you, someone's written work, someone's statement to you ever inspired you to attempt something big in your own life? Sure, we've all experienced that. That's what we call visionary leadership. They have painted a picture for us of a possible future and helped us to believe that it would be possible to reach that future. But we need a second type of leadership also, and it's the kind that Jim described. It's the when you are stuck in the swamp, because great leaders paint a picture that's out here. Right? You are in the map here. And great leaders paint a picture of this great future that you could have out here. And you look from here to there, and you're excited about it. Have you ever been excited about something in your future? Sure. What great leaders don't describe for you is this. Right? When you're 80 miles away from something, well, let's say 40 miles, because in certain parts of the country, you get out to the Rockies, you can see the peaks of the Rockies from 40 miles away. From 40 miles away, it looks like it's a straight shot right to the mountains. Great leaders describe this for you when they're visionary leaders. But we need people that can help us when we find the valleys. We need people that can help us when we get to the stream crossings and we don't know how to cross the stream. Because when you're 40 miles back and you look at the peak, you don't see all this junk in the middle. You don't see the swamps, the canyons, and everything else that you're going to have to go through to get there. So then we need a second kind of leadership. We need experienced people who have traveled through swamps, who have crossed chasms, who have done all this other stuff that you and I personally haven't done. Here's a question for you to think about. Have you done something in your life in the past that qualifies you and is an experienced leader? Some people are vision leaders, some people are experienced leaders. Do you have the capability to walk someone else through a swamp in their life? If so, by virtue of your past experience, you're a leader. Are you offering that to other people? And this is where community breaks down. All right, let's turn over to the Colossians thing, which you're at and I'm not. I actually was a few minutes ago and I apparently pulled the pens out that were marking my pages for some reason. So, all right, chapter 3. So we're going to do a little bit of intro at the top of the chapter here, beginning of chapter 3. Since then you have been raised with Christ, set your hearts on things above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things above, not on earthly things, for you died and your life is now hidden with Christ. Okay, so some people read this and they think that that means that I should spend my time thinking about Scripture and the Bible and this and that all day long. Remember how we opened this up? You are a lowercase g God. You have been authorized and given a domain and a small part of the kingdom to rule over and reign and manage for the benefit of the king. So here's how this looks. And a while ago, we did a series called King and Kingdom where we kind of mapped this out. So the term king and then the term lord, which is used in the scripture a lot, is sort of like a Middle English term that we use to describe this. In that time, there wasn't private ownership. Right? There was no such thing as personal property. That is a relatively new concept. It's only maybe 300-400 years old. Prior to that, the king simply owned everything. But the king couldn't manage everything, and so what the king did was appoint lords. And each lord had a section of the kingdom that was his to rule over. And what did the lords have? Well, the lords couldn't do all the work, and so the lords had serfs and servants. And it was the job of the serfs and the servants to make the domain of the lord work, and then the lord was accountable to the king. And so we see that basic kind of language used in the scripture to describe this relationship, but that sounds so oppressive, doesn't it? Which way does the power stream go in that? It only goes one way, doesn't it? This guy down here at the bottom doesn't say, Mr. King, I think it would be better if we did it this way. He doesn't even go one level up to middle management and say, Mr. Lord, I think we should do it. The power is all in one direction. So just hold on to that idea. Set your minds on things above, not on earthly things, for you died and your life is now hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you will also appear with Him in glory. Okay, so here's the way it is. Each of us, we'll say in this diagram, is here. What does it feel like to be there? Sometimes not so good. We resist this. We resist being here. And we will continue to resist being here until we understand that God sets up His kingdom differently. Jump down to verse 12. Therefore, as God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved. Is that the language that the king uses to describe the servants two levels down in most situations? It's not at all, is it? Therefore, as God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved, clothe yourselves with compassion and kindness and humility and gentleness and patience. Now, there's something else that we should introduce here. When you and I read the Scriptures today, we're reading a document that is several thousand years old. It has been put to the test. It is tried. People have almost formalized every word in this. Do you realize when Paul was writing this, they were creating this? And what Paul is saying is, I've noticed these communities, these small groups of people that have come together. Followers of the way, we'll call them. Right? Forget calling them Christians. We'll just call them people who are following after Jesus. And there's one guy in this part of town, and another guy in that part of town, and another guy in this part of town, and another guy in this part of town. They're the only people in that town that are followers of the way, and they come together. And what Paul is saying is, your only hope to remain together is if you start to practice these things. Let's look at them again. Clothe yourselves with compassion, with kindness, with humility, with gentleness, with patience. Bear with each other and forgive each other whatever grievances you may have against one another. Right now, that sounds so warm and fuzzy, doesn't it? Remember? One guy here, one guy there, one guy there, one guy there. The whole rest of the town. How long do you have to be in somebody's presence before they annoy you? How long do you have to be around someone before they do something that just sets you off? Right? You're not like me. I'm not like you. You seem like a really nice guy. I'll guarantee if I spend 10 hours straight with you, you would do something that would really annoy me. I guarantee you this, too. If you spent 3 hours with me, I'd do something. I'd just make that commitment to you. I would definitely annoy you. It might take you 10 to get under my skin, but I could be pretty much thoroughly under your skin in 3. Paul knows this about people. He knows that they don't naturally come together and work with each other. He knows that people aren't naturally led. He knows that people don't naturally follow. We tend to each want to rule our own kingdom with nobody else involved. He says, listen, the only way you're going to keep this community together is if you start to implement these ideas. Now, here's the thing. We don't do this well. Truthfully, we don't do this well. Do you know why we in church community get together or get along pretty well? Because we all go home to our own worlds most of the time. When this was written, these people didn't have anybody else. Right? You didn't just go to the church down the street if you didn't like the church you were at. There was no church down the street. It was the only church in town. And it was the only other group of people in the community that you could get some support from. What happens when the only people you could get some support and help from are people you don't like? And they don't like you either. So when they see you coming down the street, they lock their door because they've had more than enough of you. So the only way that this is ever going to work for you guys, Paul says, is if you begin to practice this. And then, over all these virtues, put on love, which binds them all together in perfect unity. Okay, we've defined love many times here, the type of love that's being described here. What is the definition of love that we've used? No? An active commitment to the best interest of another human being. It's not a passive commitment. Love is an active commitment to the best interest of the other human being. That means whether I want to or not, I do have to get involved in your life. When I see that there's an area of need in your life, I get involved in your life. I don't intrude in it. I don't barge in. But I don't sit passively by and wait. And then these two phrases here. Let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts. Since as members of one body, you were called to peace. And be thankful. Everybody remember that diagram? We're going to come back to it. My marker's running out of ink, so I hope you got it written down. Might not have enough by then. All right, so peace. Thankfulness. Bet you there's two L's in thankfulness. I don't know.
No?
No? Okay. What do peace and thankfulness have to do with each other? I mean, this is a nice, crisp phrase. So either Paul's just rambling on and won't shut up, and he's got a scribe that's writing it all down, so he doesn't care. He can just dictate, and the scribe keeps writing. Or there's something important here. Let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts, since as members of one body you were called to peace. Well, while you're thinking about that, first off, notice this. He's writing to the whole group. He's writing to them all together, and this letter is going to be read with everybody in the room. Have you ever been convicted in any kind of a presentation, and the guy that you had wronged was sitting somewhere else in the room? Or the guy that had wronged you was sitting somewhere else in the room? The guy that you were having issues with, or the woman that you were having issues with, they were somewhere else in the very same room. What do you think is happening in the minds of these people as they're listening to this? Well, they're thinking about all the times they didn't show kindness, they didn't show humility, they didn't show any of this, and they certainly didn't show any love to each other. And they're thinking about all this. Let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts, since as members of one body, you were called to peace. So let's establish this. Before we can do any good for each other, we have to be at peace with each other, because if we're not at peace with each other, we're not going to even want to be with each other. So he said, before we can actually help each other, we have to be able to stand to be in the same room with each other. That's a good starting point. And be thankful. Now why that in the middle of there? It seems like he's got this really good formula going on and he has to insert that stupid thing. What does thankfulness have to do with it? Well, how is the peace of Christ going to rule in my heart at the same time as I'm worried about all the stuff that's going on in my life? The peace of Christ, you know this and I know this. Your mind cannot hold two dominant thoughts at the same time. Try to be peaceful in spirit at the same time as you're worried. Try to be peaceful in spirit at the same time as you're fearful. Try to be peaceful in spirit at the same time as you're angry at the guy next to you. Do they mix? The only antidote to this, he said, is to be grateful for things. Look at the things in your life that you do have that you can be grateful for. Here's another interesting thing that we can take away and tuck in here right now. All people who get out of their stuckness start to focus not on what they don't have to solve the problem, but they focus on the few things that they do have that could help them to solve the problem. It doesn't do any good to focus your life on the things that you don't have to get out of your jam. Okay, so suppose you're stuck in the mud, and you have a tow chain, but you don't have another vehicle to tow you. And you obsess for the next hour about, boy, I need a vehicle to tow me out of this because, look, I have a tow chain, but I don't have anything else. Meanwhile, you've got some boards and a shovel in the back of the truck, but you don't do anything with it. Why? Because you're so preoccupied with the tow chain and the fact that you really just need somebody. If we focus on what we don't have, we don't take time to notice what we do have. Your mind cannot hold two things that are contradictory to each other at the same time. All right, let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts and be thankful, and let the word of Christ dwell in you richly. Okay, so we've got the peace of Christ that rules. We keep a grateful spirit. And what's the next one? Anybody? It's the word. How's it to dwell in us? Richly. Why is this practical to us? He says, the first thing you have to do if you're going to be able to work together to solve your problems and capture the greatest opportunities is you have to release from your mind all the things that are getting in the way. Look for what you do have to be thankful for. But that's not enough. It's not enough to clear your mind of the junk and be grateful for what you do have. You need to see what God is already putting in you. Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly. Remember last week we introduced an idea that James said, when do we pray for wisdom? And what kind of wisdom do we pray for? We don't pray for the kind of wisdom that it takes to get us out of a bind. We pray for the kind of wisdom that will help us go through the difficulty to the other side. So if we spend our lives praying to get out of jams, God doesn't answer that prayer. If we spend our lives praying for ways to get through the difficulty to the other side, we have an opportunity to bring glory to God. We have an opportunity to improve our area of the kingdom. And God answers that kind of prayer. The word of Christ dwelling in us richly is one of the ways by which we have better means, better understandings from which to solve the problems that confront us. So this is it. Put your mind at peace, like Christ rule in your mind. There are solutions. Be grateful for what you do have, not complaining about what you don't have. And then, with that framework of mind, you can let the word of Christ richly fill you and live in you and begin to look for solutions. The word of Christ dwell in you richly as you read. And now, listen to this. As you teach and admonish one another with all wisdom. Remember the two types of leadership that we've talked about already? It was only 15 minutes ago, so surely you can remember that. I have great hope for you. Okay, so we're visionary leaders. Then there's experience leaders. One of the things that we struggle with when we read the scriptures is we don't really see the full picture. You need to back outside of the picture in order to be able to appreciate what's going on. Who's the vision leader right now? In this, who's the vision leader? It's Paul. He is standing outside the situation, describing to them how they could accomplish something better. Paul's not even present with them, otherwise he wouldn't need to write. So Paul is somewhere else, and he's casting a vision for what their community could be like. What's he calling on them to be, to each other? Experience leaders. Look at what he's saying. You teach and admonish one another with all wisdom. What's he assuming that they have in that community? He says, among all of you, between all of you, you have collective wisdom that will help you all to solve your individual problems, your individual ministries. As you sing psalms and hymns and spiritual songs with gratitude in your hearts to God, and whatever you do, whether in word or deed, do it all in the name of the Lord Jesus. Give thanks to God the Father through Him. Do it all in the name of the Lord Jesus brings us right back to what we talked about before. that you, as the servant, marker change. Are doing things for the glory of the Lord, and make this generic now, okay? Remember how we diagrammed this. The king who owns the land appoints a lord to control the thing, and the lord in turn appoints servants to do the work in the kingdom. All right? So it says the servants are to do things in a way that brings honor and recognition up here. Why would any servant do that? Remember several weeks ago? Well, actually, by now it's more like several months ago. We talked about the foot washing story. We said that the foot washing story, we so often use that just as an example of humility, but there's so much more going on than that. Now, which takes more humility? Does it take more humility to be Jesus in that story or to be Peter? You see, each party to that equation needs humility. What kind of humility does Jesus need? The kind of humility to set aside his position and say, I am going to act lovingly. What's love? Give me the definition of love again.
Committed to the well-being of the other.
There you go. An active commitment to the well-being of another human being. That's Jesus. Jesus has an active commitment to the well-being of Peter. And so he humbles himself to serve Peter. But what's Peter's natural response? He recoils. Peter doesn't have humility. Peter says, no, I really don't want you to do that. I can't imagine you doing that. And so Peter, Jesus says, Peter, you need to humble yourself. You need to receive what I'm giving. Now, here's the difference between what we mapped out before, king at the top, lord, and then the servants. The way God describes it, we all serve each other in this kingdom, Jesus himself even being a servant to us. That's actually the way he describes it. And so he invites us into a community where humility is the only way that it works for all of us, and yet it describes it as the king up here. At the very top, has actually served us first before we even get to serve him. Now that changes the dynamic of this. And yet we still struggle with this. So we've said that every one of us is a leader and every one of us needs leaders. And yet I think there's three different kinds of people that we fall loosely into, and maybe someone will see a fourth kind of person. We have leaders who don't see themselves as anything but. I can't receive anything from somebody else. I'm the leader. What does it feel like to be the leader and know that you need the lowest person in your organization? If you're the leader and you don't see yourselves as anyone but a leader, this is we got to tell the story about ourselves. You are a leader, but you are more than a leader. All right, what's the other? So we have the leader who can't see himself as anything but a leader, and wherever he goes, he is always the leader, and therefore he can't receive from anybody else. Well, then we have the person who's the follower. And the follower doesn't see himself as anybody but a follower. What do I have to offer? What do I have to give? I couldn't possibly be a leader in this situation. And so the followers are always looking to others to give them the answers, and they never look inside themselves and say, I have this to give to my community. I can't keep quiet about this. And then we have the timid people. And they might have something good to give. They actually know they've got something good to give. They know they need to follow others at times. They need some advice because they need to get out of their stuckness. But they just sit on the sidelines and they don't do anything. They never get into the community. Have you ever sat off on the sidelines and not been either the leader who helps others to get out of their problems or the follower? You just stay off to the side because your kind of pride is the kind of pride that says, I know I'm stuck, but it would be too embarrassing to admit I'm stuck. And I'm not sure I have anything to give in the way of leadership, so I'll just stay out of everybody's way and stay off to the side. You're looking at me with glazed eyes like you don't understand any of this. This is happening. This happens. This dynamic exists right now. You know the reason that people in the outside world look to the church and they say the church doesn't have much to offer? We haven't gotten past being able to help ourselves. Now, I know that's offensive to some of you, but the reality is, if show of hands here, and I don't want anything personal. Is there an area of your life where you're stuck? Where you've been stuck? If we can't help ourselves get out of our own stuckness, what do we have to offer the world? If we can't even make this work in Christian community, what hope do we have to offer the world a way to get out of its stuckness?
You know, I think if you're out there and you're witnessing the unbelievers, that the love of Christ will transcend all understanding.
Okay.
If you're looking at it from a leadership perspective as to leaders' followers, the king at the top, the servant on the bottom, there are going to be people within any organization with any kind of leadership structure are going to be timid. But I think if you're going to be missional, you're going to go out into the world, and you're going to be missional, and you're going to share the love of Christ, that's going to transcend all understanding.
Okay.
Right.
I think it's more of a position is what Paul talks in Titus chapter 2 about the older men to teach the younger men. Older women are to teach the younger women. And he uses the word to admonish, which is rebuking, it's correcting. And we have gotten into a place in our country where if somebody rebukes us, we take offense, of bitterness, resentment, we isolate from one another. We don't take correction as a good thing.
Well, that's in the church, yeah. So we're going to have all these going on in the church, but let's use this word, if overall that local church, that local organization, fellowship is dysfunctional, we're not going to be effective in our lives, let alone this community. And let's use the biblical word, he says, you've got to be salt and light out there. Now let's make it practical, are we making a difference in our community? Are there legitimate things we're doing to make that difference? And if we're just in our circle, I can't get over myself. We're never going to be perfect, that's right. But we're not able to function. We're not going to be doing what we should be doing. We're not going to accomplish that purpose. And there's too many, let's be honest, dysfunctional local fellowships.
I think, too, those all became defining characteristics of a person, not a follower who then becomes a leader, or a leader who then raises up other people. So,
yeah, because we're all following, we're all leading, we're all, yeah. Like you showed, Jesus, followers, we're all serving, we're all.
Mm-hmm. All right. Because I think more of us struggle with feeling ourselves to be leaders in some area, I put together a simple list of things that I think, and some of these come from my own experience. Honestly, last Sunday I was thinking about this, and I was thinking about an area of stuckness in my own life. One of these things that never seems to get any better, the solution just never seems to arrive, and how easy and how tempting it is to just quit and just throw in the towel on the whole thing. I'm thinking, you know, I need some resources. And I'm just thinking about this privately, personally. And I realize that sometimes what somebody needs is just somebody to come alongside of them, next to them, and say, I've done this before, I've been here before, I know exactly how to get you out of that jam if you'll just do this. So here are some of the things. And you see them written down here. But I'd like you to think of the people in your life. Here are some of the things that great leadership does. I keep picking up. Here.
As they say, go.
We need people to inspire us. Who in your life needs some inspiration today? And I don't mean a cute phrase, right? We know the difference between cute. Have you ever been encouraged in a way that wasn't encouraging? Right? You know what I'm saying? Somebody gives you some cheap platitude and they think they're being helpful to you, but frankly all they're being is annoying because they don't even understand what they said and they don't understand the depth of your difficulty right at that moment. Right? We need people who can inspire us. Here's a big one. We need people in the moment who can give us hope. What does it take to give somebody else hope? Okay. Who has given you hope with their expressions? And whose expressions have given you no hope and just made you irritated at them? What's the difference?
Someone with experience is more likely to give you
a grounded and meaningful hope. Why? They've been there and they've been to the other side. The people who bring us the most hope in life, who have been through the swamp and can report back to us, there is another side where there's dry land again. Right? That's what we need. And so whatever it is that we're stuck in, we need some sort of hope that there could be a better future. All right, here's another one. We need leaders who can coach us. We started off this series and we diagrammed out what spiritual fitness is, right? And we said that it takes a process to get to spiritual fitness. Are you spiritually fit more so than you were 5 years ago? Have you learned a collection of things that help you to remain and retain your spiritual fitness? Is there somebody else in your life who can benefit from your experience this week? I mean, don't make this some generic thing where you say, well, these are nice ideas, and then take them home and just... You're going to throw this away? Don't throw this away. Who are you going to act on, and whose life are you going to act in this week as a result of what you're doing right now, what you're hearing right now? Sometimes we do need people to just challenge us. Is there someone in whose life you see great potential, but they're not using it? They're just not doing anything with it. You see that they've got capability, and what would it take to challenge them? Sometimes the best way to challenge someone is to invite them into an opportunity with you. Right? You see someone and you think you could help them a little bit, so you just invite them along to experience life with you a little bit at your level doing something that you're doing. If it's not for them, that's okay. We've talked about providing vision. We do need people to correct us. The reason I'm writing them up here, you have them written on your sheet, and you can look at them later if you want to. But I want you to think about this in your own life. If we are all people who need leaders but are leaders, and we saw right there, Paul calls on the people in Colossae to teach each other. That means it's a foregone conclusion, he believes, that God has poured stuff into their lives and they have experienced stuff in their life that equips them to be able to teach each other. And the final way is to demonstrate by example. Each of these is a form of leadership. Another reason we're writing these up here is because many of us don't see ourselves as leaders. You need to see that if you have one of these capabilities, you can lead other people. This demonstrating by example. There's this phenomena that it didn't used to be possible, but how many of you have learned something or how to do something new as a result of watching a YouTube video in the last year? Right? Is that not incredible? What does that prove? That we all learn readily from watching the example of somebody else doing something. Anybody want to share something they learned?
Well, I've listened to hundreds of sermons and learned scripture. Until I end up sharing it somewhere, whether Baba, one of the folks working there, you know, or somebody asking us what we're doing, but it would be something that I've heard in the sermon online, or Pastor John, being here, kids learned how to make bracelets too out of soda top cans.
There you go.
That was pretty amazing.
Anybody else?
I learned how to clean the chlorine generator on a swimming pool from YouTube.
There you go. Isn't that so amazingly practical? See? We can do this.
I get the brakes on my wife's Subaru. Rotors, brake pads, everything.
There you go.
The rotors on my wife's Subaru.
Now,
ours was with the ice dispenser in our fridge. Yeah, we replaced it apart.
Now, just to double down on this, and yours is a great example. Have you ever noticed how poor in quality a lot of the YouTube videos are? I mean, the guy's got his little GoPro thing that's on his head, and every time he looks the other way, the camera follows his head when he goes the other way, and the lighting's awful, and you have to squint to make things out. But is it helpful? Yeah. Is he a great teacher? No, but can you learn from him? Yes. And is your life better because of the fact that even though it wasn't excellently crafted, it is, right? The brakes are fixed and it saved you a ton of money even if he wasn't great.
Good. I'm always a little leery. Now, this is really easy, something.
I had all the tools to do. I just never did it before, so I just pulled it up and did it.
Good for you.
And as a result of that, you're not stuck. Now, I'm not saying that the brakes were an issue of stuckness in your life, but can't we take that same analogy, huh?
Money was.
Oh, there you go, money was. Can't we take that same analogy and start to believe in ourselves that we really do have things to offer each other in the inner man? Is that not possible? I got one more text I want to read. If I come back to it and can find it here. There we go. Okay, so again, Paul, the thought leader, the visionary leader, standing outside the community, looking in on the community, talking to them for their own good, and he said, therefore, encourage one another and build each other up, just as in fact you are doing, meaning doing now. There's a prerequisite to that. You know what the prerequisite is? In order for somebody to build you up, they really need to know something about you. What do they need to know? Well, do you build something up when it's already built up as much as it needs to be? See, you build things up that are broken down. You build things up that are low so that they're where they belong. You build things up that are in need of something. What does that require? I feel like I'm pulling teeth sometimes.
Why? Somebody's doing something. Like I spent 10 years making millionaires, more millions, by giving up myself and my experience to the point of heartbreak where I just couldn't do it anymore. But I knew their why wasn't to help people be safe. In fact, they would put safety aside if it meant their bottom line would be a higher dollar amount.
I guess here's the thing that I was looking for. I can't build you up if I don't know where you're beaten down. And the only way sometimes that I can know where you're beaten down is if you tell me. Haven't we all had this discussion with our wives? And right? The wife says, well, you should just know. Right? Has that conversation ever taken place? And you're, well, you should just know that. Well, how should you just know that? And in the same way, if we take that out into our community, like here. How should I just know where you're beaten down and where you need to be built up if you don't ever open up and share that? And that's why we said that if we're all leaders, but we're also all followers, We're comfortable being one or the other, but we don't seem to be comfortable at both. And Paul is saying the only way the community works is if we become both and become natural at being both. I need to be more candid with you about where I need to be built up, which is where I'm broken now. Why don't we do that? Because that's the most tender sore spot of who we are. Right? Don't touch that. That already hurts. I don't want you messing with that. Don't fix my broken bone. It's already hurt. And what is it going to take to make the broken bone better? Sometimes it's going to take more pain. So I'd rather you not meddle in my life right now. My life hurts enough. The last thing I want is more pain in my life. Or I have to admit that if I'm the leader guy, I have to admit that I don't have the answer to this thing in my life. And what is that? What kind of person does that make me? You know, one of the things that I like about CR, and I thought about that for dealing with this, one of the things that I like about CR is that most of the people that are in CR have gotten beyond the point where they're trying to hide where they're broken. In other words, they're already so freaking broken that it's out of the box, right? There is no hiding this brokenness anymore. It's out there. The world knows they're broken. It's like the rambler sitting in somebody's backyard with weeds that high growing around it. You know it's shot. It's no good anymore. The problem with most of us is that our... What? Do you have a rambler in your backyard? I didn't just offend you.
No, it's rambler.
It's the way you described it. It sounds so beat down.
Is that true? You think people don't know what a rambler is?
Yeah.
Show of hands, how many people know what a rambler is? You don't know what a rambler is.
American Motors Corporation.
Yeah. See, most of us, our brokenness is far more concealed. Our stuckness is manageable, and as long as our stuckness is manageable, we're not going to do anything about it. So one of the things that we looked at last week, remember we said that you will never improve as long as you can learn to tolerate where you are. So you have a choice. You can improve your threshold of tolerance so that you can tolerate more pain in your area of brokenness, or you can improve your humility equation and say, I am broken in this area, and therefore I do need some help. But there's a corollary to that. Because if I am going to get to the point where I will no longer tolerate the stuckness in my life, and I am going to reach out to people in my community and say, I am broken here and I do need to be led here, I need a specific kind of leader to lead me. What kind of leader does it take to lead somebody who's broken and damaged? It takes a leader with a very careful touch in order to do that. Right? It's the same way with the guy that's resetting the bone. Right? A skilled surgeon can reset the bone even if it requires pain, and in the end it'll be better. But a hack just makes things worse and brings a lot of discomfort in the process. And so we need to become, and this is where the peace of God with the Word of God dwelling in us together equip us to be both leaders and followers to help each other in community. So I want to just leave us with this idea. We are all stuck somewhere, and yet in another area, we all have great things to offer. We need to become more open and transparent followers, and we need to become more deft and capable leaders who can handle people's lives with a careful touch.